I'd like to propose a toast.
Hello and welcome to Before Brunch. I'm Megan Cassidy.
And I'm Cassie Delaney.
And we are your weekly celebrity, pop culture, social issues and arts podcast. And we go live every Sunday morning at around 11 a.m.
And we like to talk about all the things that you're going to be talking to your pals about at brunch. We take the things that have happened in the media, on the internet, in the news, everywhere during the week. And we try and make sense of them and make them relevant for our lives and therefore your lives.
We are now brought to you by Diet Coke in conjunction with their Because I Can campaign. And we will now open a can of Coke and crack on.
This is my favourite part.
I know.
So this week we're actually going to look at our biggest stories of the year and the kind of segments and stuff that we covered that got the best reaction. So first up, we're looking at our topic of the shared experience, because dozens of you reached out to us after this to share your own thoughts and your experiences of the same thing.
So when we were coming up to research this piece, we kind of were surprised by how few pieces there were or articles there had been written about the importance of shared experience. And this is something that we have often talked about or touched upon, because I suppose given our careers and our roles working in content, media and all that kind of stuff, we have often talked about the importance of content and literature and media is about creating a shared experience for people. So it's about it's about putting forward thought or opinion or content that people can relate to and understand and talk about. So, and that's what we feel about these books as well, is that it's about sharing in the shared experience. Sharing in the shared experience, that was very articulate, go me. So I came across this one piece in The Atlantic, which is actually from 2014. It is a piece by Olga Kazan called The Importance of Sharing Experiences. And it's basically pulling apart a study that was done in the Harvard Decision Science Laboratory, where they took 68 participants and they were broken into groups of four. So in the groups of four, three people were shown a kind of mundane cartoon, a low budget kind of cartoon clip. And one person was shown a video of a street magician performing like really impressive tricks for a very appreciative crowd. And then after they were shown these clips, the four people were brought back into a room together and asked about how they felt and their experiences. First of all, they were given a couple of minutes to talk about it. And then they were surveyed and asked two questions. How do you feel right now? And how did you feel during the interaction that just took place? So they're talking about the interaction, talking to their peers. And it was a 100-point scale, and it ranged from excluded to included. And surprisingly, the people who had watched the exceptional video felt worse than the people who had watched the mundane, ordinary video, because they felt on average about 30 points more excluded than their peers. So obviously you can imagine this happening, that you've experienced something on your own, you're going back into a room, and while your experience technically or subjectively trumps the experience that they've had, the fact that there's three people there talking about a shared experience makes the person who's had the exceptional experience feel more isolated. And there's loads of comment and talk about this and what kind of impact this has and how this will, you know, how this makes people feel and how you should apply these kind of learnings to your life. And basically, there's a really some really interesting kind of thought in this piece, but it just goes to show that people bond more over relatable instances rather than exceptional ones. And there's other studies that are like in this piece in The Atlantic about how if you eat dark chocolate with someone, it tastes different to when you eat it on your own. You will experience things at a more intense and heightened rate when you're doing them with someone else as opposed to doing them when you're on your own. But it's a really interesting study, because it kind of takes into consideration people who would often go off and like travel or experience things on their own don't anticipate the isolation they're going to feel when they return, or the isolation they're going to feel when they come back to their peers. And it's again back to that idea of like expectation versus reality, or your anticipating self and your remembering self, is that when you question someone, you ask them, what do you think will make you happier, or what do you think will give you the best experience? Everyone's going to say, oh, the skydive over a pint in the local pub with three of my mates. They're going to be like, oh yeah, I'd go to New Zealand and do the skydive. But actually what they're finding is that the people who are coming back from those exceptional experiences, obviously that's a really stark comparison, but the people who are coming back from that once-off kind of individual experience are feeling more isolated and less satisfied than they thought they would be afterwards.
It's such a great piece, and like so many different parts of it resonated with me. But the first thing I thought was, yes, there's exceptional experiences versus mundane ones, but taking it to the other end of the scale, nothing bonds you with a person or a group better than going through something terrible together or having some sort of bad experience. Like, I go on press trips sometimes where we would have a massive assemble of people from all across the media industry that I might never have met before, might work in completely different areas or genres to me. And the better and more swimmingly the press trip goes, the less friends I make. If something bad happens to us, like we get caught in a storm, or we I fall off the back of my fucking paddleboard and inhale a lot of water and have to be like taken back to shore,
is this from
that
experience?
Happened. Yeah, and I made such a good friends off the back of that because it was so awful.
Yeah,
and it's so true about, so you travel alone, there's sort of this expectation that come home and don't bore everyone with how good it was. Like, come home and tell people about the shit bits, or
this study is really interesting as well, because there are two ends to the scale. So it also says that when you experience something negative in a group, you experience it, you perceive it to be far more negative than you would on your own. Comparably. So I think it just really comes back to the fact that people will connect with you more when we're talking about something that they can relate to. So it's very, very difficult if you're coming back and you've done your skydive and then you're walking into the local pub and you expect the three people who have not left to be able to understand the experiences of doing a skydive when they haven't done it.
Yeah.
It's hard. We actually, as humans, I don't think can, obviously we can imagine it and we can listen and we can, you know, emphatically talk about how wonderful that might be, but until you've experienced something, it's very, very hard to feel that connection about it.
Yeah.
So there's just going to be that distance there.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're on holidays and you're going on your travels and you're coming back and you're talking about how your luggage got lost, that's relatable because that has probably happened. And while you can talk about how it happened to you in, you know, in the back country of Vietnam, and someone else might be talking about how it happened to them going over to fucking the south of France, it's still a relatable concept that people can engage with.
That's it. And it feeds so well into the conversation we just had, in that, so say the likes of Eleanor and Keiko are on the outskirts of the community. They're not in the group, but they're almost perceived as lesser than the group. And we want, as a community, to pull them up and to make sure, get into the group, and we're reaching down and, come on, be normal, like, come up here, come up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, once we're all here, we don't want anyone going up above us, like leaving the group the other way. So it's like the lobster pot, in that if something really good happens to someone or they've gone through something amazing, our instinct awfully is to pull them back down a notch. It's, hold on, don't get too fucking special. Like,
but it's
come back.
So instinctive. I mean, it's so instinctive when you are looking at it from the perception of your group, or safe within your group. And it is, I mean, there's loads of things that feed off this study. There's groupthink, there's mob mentality, there's the fact that you will be influenced so greatly by the people around you without realizing it. But I think what is so particularly interesting is that when you think about yourself as an individual, it's so, you just, because I think we don't even realize that we are being influenced by the people around us, it's just so easy to disregard them and think to yourself, oh, I'd be so much happier if I was away on a beach on my own reading a book, blah, 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 blah. And in actual fact, what this is saying is that you will not be happier. Yeah. You might think you will be, but you will not be happier. In fact, you could end up feeling a lot worse because you're isolating yourself from what we all want at our core, which is just shared experience.
That's it.
So instead of going far flung off on your own, maybe consider doing other things closer with a group or finding your tribe or whatever it is, and just finding those people to connect with. Because at the end of the day, that's seemingly what makes people the happiest. Of course, there's people outside of that, and it doesn't apply for everyone, but it's just a really interesting perspective. Now, this doesn't shit all over people who go off traveling and saying that, you know, you shouldn't do that, and you should just go down to the pub, or you should just sit with your pals and just have a chat or whatever. But it just kind of recommends that if you are going to do things that are, you know, extraordinary experiences, to do them kind of, make sure they are novel and do them planned out or do them whatever. But it did interesting also say that even doing them with a stranger who you've just met still makes them more intense than doing them completely on your own.
Really? Yeah. It is. Another interesting part was about how, as you're saying there, keep these experiences novel, do them rarely, how quickly we normalize good things. So how quickly, if say you get a new job offer and you're elated, you're on top of the world, and then how quickly does that become the new normal? And it's also relative. Like, say, I went to an event last night at a salon in town for the launch of Miss Universe. When I was 21, I probably would have gone home and cried myself to sleep because of how beautiful all the beauty queens were and how I'm not one of them. But then I was looking at them last night. I went with my friend, who's also not a beauty queen, that she like won't mind me saying. And we were in our work gear and we were on the outskirts of the community at the event. But I was looking at them and it becomes so relative so quickly. So yes, they're in the competition. You can guarantee they feel as bad as we do in that they feel like someone else is prettier. So once you get to that level, you're there, and then you normalize and you go, okay, what's next and who's prettier? And some of those girls in that group 100% felt worse than me and Kira did in our like shirts and ripped jeans. And
well, see, now you know, now as a more educated listener of Before Brunch, quoting this 2014 Atlantic article, you know that were you the prettiest girl in the room, you probably would have felt more isolated and therefore not as actually happy.
I mean, the novelty wears off.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I wasn't the prettiest girl in the room, just that I
was. Sorry, I was reading between the lines.
Don't know how you deducted that.
Okay, sorry.
Just that I wasn't in the competition. You know?
Sorry, that was my misunderstanding.
Yeah, you misunderstood.
But you did point out that Kira probably wasn't the prettiest person in the room there, which was horrendous.
Kira is one of the most beautiful people, and you know Kira as well. She's absolutely stunning. And in fact, the photographer took her aside to take her picture, even though she was dressed quite appallingly, I think she won't mind me saying, because she shines like a light. And myself and Kira were very bonded in the shared experience of not being Miss Universe contestants.
Which will make you happy. Now, this theory is freeing, because you can sit there, you know, sit tight in your happiness, knowing that that would make you happier than the alternative, which would be to go on and to win and to have to travel the world on your own.
That's it. And what made us very happy afterwards was a massive cheese board and some chicken liver pate and a bottle of wine.
Saw that on your story. It did look absolutely stunning.
And even not to harp on about Love Island, but it's definitely, that's another shared experience that we're all enjoying. And I think what, you know, provokes the most conversation is the awful things that happen to people like Laura, who I actually do think it warrants an episode about how ageist Twitter is.
Oh my God, yes. And it's so terrifying. Laura is approximately 6 months older than I am. At a push, I would say.
All of these kids on Twitter are like, when is she going to hit the menopause? And why isn't she being with people her own age? And if my granny ever acted like that, I'd be appalled.
I just don't feel like I was like that when I was 23 or 20. Like, these, they're not
certainly
that much of a difference.
No, it's crazy.
It's terrifying. Because, I mean, I work with people and there's that age difference. And I hope that they're not looking at me being like, oh my God, is she on the menopause?
On the menopause. But I have a very shared experience with Laura right now. Like, and even my boyfriend keeps saying, oh, you know, he references her age all the time. And I'm like, Aiden, I'm the same age as her. And I'm here with you right now. It's hurtful. But yeah. Look, we're so young. We really are young. But, you know, that's a shared experience that we have with.
Yeah. So there we go. Like, I think we've really just this reading this piece for me and reading into this kind of Harvard study just really made me understand like my motivations and the things I do inherently and like the, you know, those feelings that you have where you just want to go hang out with your pals or, you know, be with your family or whatever, or do things, even mundane things that you enjoy, but you're doing them with someone special, then that's kind of why I'm not motivated to actually go out and do things that are particularly exciting, because I understand this. And it really just goes back to your kind of, you know, when you're a teen and you're like, but mom, everyone is doing it.
Mm-hmm. But if they jumped off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge? Maybe you'd just be happier to follow them.
Probably. Groupthink. You probably would just jump off the bridge. You'd be like, it must be safe if everyone else is doing it.
Moral of the story, don't bother trying to think for yourself. Fit in.
Conform.
Conform.
Conform. That's it.
Next up, we have our segment on Bloggers Unveiled, which was obviously a huge story during the year. And we decided to talk about this after Love in Dublin were targeted by the account. And we looked at the impact naming and shaming people publicly has on the journalist or the person who's being named and shamed. And we also questioned why it was that we so collectively were happy to see people being called out.
So moving on to the topic of the week, which is people innately loving to watch other people suffer.
Yes.
And it's something we've touched on numerous times just because it is part of being a human. And it's something that we're aware of in ourselves. And then you have to actively try not to enjoy other people's suffering every day.
Isn't there a German word that literally, it's like Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude, isn't it?
It's enjoying other people's misery.
I mean, when you think about it, a lot of soap operas, a lot of our pop culture is based on the fact that people enjoy
pain,
other people's misery, in that you get a kind of, it's probably the nicest way to think about it is that there's a sort of catharsis that while this other person's in pain, you're not, or you might feel better about your pain, or it helps you to better appreciate the pain that you're not in. So we can watch the Kardashians and watch them all bawling crying because their sister's going to jail and feel a little bit better about ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, but that's when it's far removed, you know.
Yeah.
And that's when, and obviously like watching dramas or watching horror films where you're going to get scared and nothing's actually going to affect you is cathartic. Like, that feels good. That's fine when you can experience something without the threat of anything bad actually happening to your life. You get to feel those emotions, but you don't have to deal with the aftermath. There's been a couple of things this week that I want to talk to you about that have been very close to home, obviously.
Yeah.
And for you, and I know for you've had an experience this week with an Instagram account that a lot of people are following and invested in and really, I suppose, being quite, people are being quite critical of it now because everyone, I think, agrees that it has gone a step too far. So we're obviously talking about Bloggers Unveiled, which originated as an Instagram account that was catching out bloggers who were predominantly in road safety authority ads and not wearing their seatbelts, which had a purpose, which was calling people out. Then it kind of moved on to sort of calling people out for false advertising. It was naming and shaming bloggers. It was naming and shaming influencers. This week they came after you guys.
Yes. So we battled, we back and forthed about whether we would talk about the situation and the Instagram account because it's that perennial problem of, oh, do you give it more publicity or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of crucial to the thoughts that we're having at the moment and sort of segues nicely into thoughts we've been having about Love Island. Yes, we're going to talk about it again.
Of course we are.
Of course we are. But it's kind of the theme of the moment is, why are we enjoying watching other people's suffering and why is it so obsessive and addictive? So I loved the original iteration of Bloggers Unveiled. I loved that. I know the RSA piece was big for them, but I loved that they were going after people for their advertising standards and kind of taking the influencer marketing phenomenon, pulling it apart a little bit and helping us to better regulate
it. Exposing fake followers, exposing fake influence, exposing people who are like profiting off lies and manipulation.
And I think that's really important. And it was really important at the time because it was getting to an all-time kind of crux we didn't know what to believe online, what was real, what wasn't. And it was time because there's so many financial transactions that are solely based on your Instagram profile and your following. It was time for it to be regulated in some way because people are parting with their money. Mm-hmm. Not only brands who are spending with influencers, but people at home who are believing the hashtag ads that aren't hashtagged ad and parting with their money. So it was time for something like this to happen. But power corrupts, and this account now has a lot of power.
This account has lost the run of itself.
It's I always liken it to maybe it's as if two people are running the account. There's one person who I believe is a female who is so clever, but there's a sort of a kindness there. There's like someone who has a conscience and is doing this for right.
The one who's sharing all the pictures of the lost dogs. Every time a dog gets lost in Dublin, you get it up in Bloggers Unveiled because they have a massive. So in essence, it started as an account that was to undermine and expose influencers. And now the account itself has 200,000 followers. So it itself now has a lot of influence.
It's an influencer.
Yeah, which is there is so many hypocrisies in this account and what is going on here. First of all, the fact that it is anonymous, I understand that someone is trying to protect themselves, but that's one of the issues is not being transparent and not being open and honest with who you are and who these influences are.
Yeah, this is a conversation we had in the week. It's encouraging the trolling sort of thing. So the idea of a troll is someone who's anonymous and sitting behind a computer and is a keyboard warrior and can say whatever they want without consequence. So originally that was utilized in a really positive way because she was exposing things that, you know, that needed to be exposed. But now she's really just trolling people and there is no fear of consequence and there is no verification. And that's something that we'll get to talking about, is how brands then get caught up in this and how anybody can send a message in about any brand and she will post it and ruin people. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, we saw it happen with Carrie's Closet, but this week it happened to a brand that we were affiliated with. So everything's different when it happens to you, of course. And I know we had a Waterford Whispers article written about Lovin a couple of weeks ago, and I texted into the group and I was like, I know it's just because it's me. I don't think it's funny, but I don't think this is funny.
Of course, it's like when it's close to bone. But I think you especially are still very objective, and you do have the ability to say when something, you're the first person to turn around and be like, oh yeah, it's poking fun at me, but it's still funny.
I'd be like, that's actually gas. There's nothing I can do about it, whatever. But this one was just so far off the mark. So they came, so we're all sitting at the desk and it was you, Cassie, that sent me the screenshot.
Was that the first you'd seen of it?
That was the first I'd seen of it.
Okay.
So our fear is always Bloggers Unveiled. Obviously, everything we do, we try to do absolutely in the most transparent way possible. Mm-hmm. It's been a good thing for us that influencer marketing has been exposed, because now people are more savvy to what branded content looks like and how it should look. And we work with brands all the time. Mm-hmm. And we work really hard to make sure that everything is above board and that the followers are never being misled. So your fear is, what if Bloggers Unveiled latches on to something maybe that's historical, or maybe that she's misread or something? And it's a fear.
Or is just wrong.
Is wrong. So Cassie sent the screenshot and I saw Bloggers Unveiled. I'm used to getting screenshots from Bloggers Unveiled. I think it's probably one of the most shared thing in WhatsApp at the moment. And I saw it was our girl, Aideen, and it was a piece that she had done that was sponsored. It was a sponsored showcase of a product, which is Zero One's hair treatments. Zero One is a salon in town, in Dublin. And she had had a cut, colour and treatment. Mm-hmm. So there was a before and after photo. The after photo
was phenomenal.
Is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So I remember the day that Aideen was getting this done. I texted her. I said, this is insane. Like, that transformation is incredible. And she was like, I know, my hair looks incredible. She came into the office. It looked exactly as it did in the photo. It was, everyone was talking about it. It was an incredible hair transformation. The Diet Coke Because I Can campaign is about carefree fun with friends and celebrating the things in life that make you feel good. Take part in the Diet Coke Because I Can series by following hashtag Because I Can.
Yeah.
And we were all thrilled with it and went, you know, sponsored all over it. It was a sponsored showcase. Boom. Yeah. Got loads of traction. We posted it. We post 60 things to Facebook a day on across, and our social channels across both sites. So the next day, obviously, Bloggers Unveiled picked this up. People had got in touch with her saying that there was extensions in the after photo, which I knew that wasn't true.
Yeah.
So I called Aideen. I said, Aideen, I know that I saw you that day. There was no extensions. Can you just confirm for me 100% before I go into Bloggers Unveiled here that there was no extensions? Mm-hmm. And she said, no, there was no extensions. And I knew that anyway. Mm-hmm. And got back onto Bloggers Unveiled, ended up having a massive argument with whoever this person is all day.
But this is the thing. And this is, I feel like she has completely undermined, or whoever's running this account has now undermined every bit of credibility. Because I know 100% that Aideen didn't have extensions. Mm-hmm. And she was still pushing forward it. And then had like her evidence and supporting evidence was people DMing her saying, I've worked as a hairdresser for 10 years and that's 100% extensions. And it wasn't. It was just a really fucking good, it was just a really good haircut. And I've also had curly blow dryers where I've had 16 brushes in my hair at one time. And
you have walked
so
in here looking like you look like you have fucking 2,000 grand worth of hair extensions in your head. And you've just had a fabulous curly blow dry.
It fucking happens, right? It absolutely happens. And then the explanation was so brilliant that it was like, no, it's just a really nice blow dry. And my head is tilted back. And you can see it. It's so clearly not extensions. That now I don't trust anything that Bloggers Unveiled has put up at all. Like, yeah. I'm even like, fucking, I'm going to go back to Carrie's closet. They're grand.
Yeah. See, I love this support. So that even my sisters were texting me saying, like, what is going on? This is ridiculous. She's after it. And they are the biggest fans of Bloggers Unveiled. Yeah. So we were in a tricky position because we were like, okay, we love Bloggers Unveiled. We talk about her all the time in the office. But now we're the targets and it's fucked up. Can we just change tact so quickly? We're just, yeah, you know,
but
we just don't like her anymore.
But it's wrong.
But it was wrong. So we were like, okay, she knew it was wrong. Like, DM'd me saying, you know, I'm just responding to what my followers are saying. And I'm saying, well, that's the problem here. You have 200,000 followers and you are not doing any sort of verification. You didn't get in touch with us to ask us if there was extensions. Let us explain what was going on. Let us show you that her head is tilted back. Send you the video where there's no extensions. So we went through the rigmarole of getting the statement from the salon and trying to, you know, Aideen did the video where she showed she had no bonds.
Yeah.
And Bloggers Unveiled just switch lanes. I was like,
yeah,
do you know
straight
what?
Away.
0-1 are shite. And anyway, they use hairspray extensions instead of gold fever.
It was still like, I can't accept that this isn't real, but I'm going to go and shame them in any way that I can. And of course, again, it was just more and more and more lies. So it leads me to believe that Bloggers Unveiled isn't someone who works in the media or isn't someone who works in PR like a lot of people had anticipated.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about how fucking terrible that day must have been for Aideen. And I had something similar happen to me that I still cannot talk publicly to people about because I had such a bad experience once working in journalism where I made a mistake and was publicly shamed and named and it was fucking awful. And it took me a really long time. It was only the other day that I was listening to a really good podcast called Terrible Thanks for Asking. And their second episode is about a journalist working in New York who makes a mistake in a piece and completely leaves journalism.
Really?
Changes career altogether. Could not deal mm-hmm. with the shame. And this was before public shaming. And I know Aideen had put up a piece in her own story about being worried about her reputation because the media in Ireland is really, really small. You know, when something like that happens to you, when you make a mistake and your name is dragged on Twitter or you're being dragged on the Sean Moncrief show on News Talk, it's personal. Mm. Like, young journalists make mistakes.
Yeah.
Everybody makes mistakes in their career. Absolutely everybody. And this is why I think it's so trolling and everything is just so detrimental. I don't think people realize that behind the articles that they don't like or behind the headlines that they don't like, there are real actual people. And negativity like that and trolling and the kind of extent of the comments that people make, like when you were called a dumb titty bitch and someone told me to go bang my head against a wall until I died.
Yeah.
Like, these things have a huge effect on your mental health and your confidence in your ability to be a journalist or whatever. Mistakes happen because there are no defined rules there yet for online journalism especially. So we're pushing the boundaries. Things change. you know, mistakes are made.
Mistakes are made. People think that these people are fair game, or that big publications, like you were working for a big publication when you made that mistake. Aideen is working for a publication that people feel they can bash and not worry about the individual that's actually involved. Love Island is a massive TV show. We don't think about the individuals who are crying, and they're really crying. Aideen is a young girl. She's a young journalist.
A very, very talented one as well.
Extremely talented. Is not a blogger. Is not someone who is 9 to 5 working for her own brand. Is someone who would never lie, genuinely, just wouldn't. Would never say that she wasn't wearing extensions when she was. And so it's a big accusation to say that, you know, she's only 23 years old, to say that she has gone on and misled people deliberately and collaborated with a brand to mislead other people is just really, really damaging.
Yeah.
People like Joanne Larby, the makeup fairy, the sort of revelations about her, I thoroughly enjoyed. I that's where I was obsessed with Bloggers Unveiled. I loved it. Then it came to a point where it was, as you're saying, trolling an individual that we need to put ourselves in her shoes. Why does she feel like she has to do this? She's also a victim of social media influence culture.
Yeah.
So there is a point where, yes, we can unveil if she has bought followers or if she hasn't marked something hashtag ad. But do we take video footage of her when we're at the same event as her, put it up as Bloggers Unveiled so that Joanne knows that the person's at the event? That's sinister.
Yeah.
It's bullying and it's trolling.
It is sinister. And I have a huge problem as well with Bloggers Unveiled posting screenshots of DMs and keeping people's names in them. It's like, if you're going to protect yourself, don't put someone else's name out there. There has to be consistencies in what you're doing. Yes, have a conversation or prompt conversation or whatever you want to do, but you can't name and shame someone else while you yourself get to stay behind a keyboard and be safe. I know, totally. I was actually terrified to have this conversation about Bloggers Unveiled because the last thing I want to do is end up in those fucking Insta stories. I don't want to. Yeah. It's a constant fear that I have, is that I'm going to say something or be shamed for it or whatever. And I'm not really even working in the public eye anymore. I genuinely had to take a break from it because it has such an effect on your mental health. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's gone way too far. I think it is sinister. I haven't had any interaction with them personally, but I think that I'm going to trust you when you say that it's not intelligent. They're making a lot of mistakes. They're completely now devaluing the stuff that they did at the start because I just can't trust them because I know that they're not verifying anything. And I think that they're nasty, and I think it's time for it to end. It's a very gossipy girl kind of thing, and it's just time for it to end. Like.
Yeah, it's gone gossip girl, it's gone unintelligent, and it's gone nasty. And when it comes to the point where the brand that we had worked with and had done a really good job on Aideen's hair is then a target of an attack from an account that has nearly the same amount of followers as we do, it's really difficult to sort of be able to justify that in your head. And they were then attacked by people who are sending messages in who get to remain anonymous, who say that they had a bad experience in 01. And then this girl, whoever at Bloggers Unveiled is posting those messages and without verifying that this person isn't a competitor. But look, we're not guiltless.
No, absolutely not. And look, we have schadenfreuded it for the last couple of weeks, and I follow it, and that's a problem. And I've been watching it without much conscience or without much thought.
Yeah.
And it's obviously very easy to say that it's gone too far, but it just really has. And it's not because it happened this week too. I've been noticing things for a long time with it that I think is really bad. And maybe it takes it being close to the bone for people to realise the effect that it has on it, and the effect that naming and shaming people online has on the person. Maybe it's the good weather, but I just think that we should, you know, all be nice to each other.
I think that's always a good thing to think. The Diet Coke Because I Can campaign is about carefree fun with friends and celebrating the things in life that make you feel good. Take part in the Diet Coke Because I Can series by following hashtag Because I Can.
Finally, we look at our chat about consent. So we had this conversation following the Belfast rape trial. And the reason we approached this topic was because so many of you reached out to us and asked us to talk about it. And well, we were really nervous doing it and obviously wanted to treat it with the utmost care. We received great feedback from you guys about it, and obviously I think it was an important conversation to have and one that clearly resonated with a lot of people.
There is one big thing that people are talking about this week that we're going to talk about. And before we get into the conversation, we want to preface it with a few things. So firstly, a lot of people contacted us asking to talk about this because it's in line with a lot of the stuff that we've talked about before. When Megan and I started Before Brunch, we did so with the intention of having a platform that we could break down conversations and hash out the issues that affected women in Ireland today. And so while we're going to talk about the kind of sentiment surrounding the Belfast rape trial, it's important to know that we don't have the answers. We don't have any definitive answers to anything that went on, and we don't have viewpoints on whether these guys were guilty or not, because we weren't part of the court and we weren't there. So we're not going to talk about the specifics of the trial. We're going to talk about consent as a whole.
Yeah, and I think that's what's really important, is that this is all about unpacking and trying to piece things together. That's what conversation is for, is to try and figure things out. Sometimes you get to a resolution. Sometimes me and Cassie, by the end of a podcast, will have settled on something that is almost an answer. And then a lot of the times we won't. And I think certainly in this case, we will not have the answers. If we did, we'd be able to change the world. Consent is one of the trickiest issues and the biggest issues, one of the biggest social issues of our time. And if anything positive has come from what's happened, it's that this conversation is to the forefront of people's minds, and people are more aware that consent is an issue and are thinking a little bit harder about what consent means, what's yes and what's no. The rally yesterday was incredibly powerful. No matter what you believe or know of the court case, I had goosebumps and tears in my eyes just seeing all those women come together and unite their voices. And everyone who took the stage, took the platform to speak, spoke so powerfully and articulately. It was as if they were touched by some sort of a muse or something. Yeah. It was amazing. So no matter what you feel about the I Believe Her hashtag or campaign, it's a good moment for women's voices. I think we're making sure that we're heard.
Yeah, I mean, let's start there and talk about the I Believe Her campaign, because obviously this has been quite a contentious thing that started trending after the verdict was announced. Was a lot of people were taking to Twitter and social media and saying, I believe her. And I think that this hashtag is one of the most powerful and one of the most important things that we have done as an Irish, like that we could do in Irish society right now. And I think that a lot of people are missing the point with it. It isn't to say we believe that girl specifically. Well, many do, and I'm not going to give my personal opinion on it, but while many people do believe her story, that sounds like it sounds like I'm dismissing it. I'm not dismissing it at all. I think a lot of people were tweeting support of that one girl, but I think the vast majority of people were tweeting support for all victims and all people, and saying, I will believe you if something happens to you and you want to come forward and you want to report it.
And that's certainly the positive that I'm taking from that hashtag, because I've conflicted feelings about it. But one thing that I do really appreciate is that there is a young girl somewhere who feels like she's on her own, and seeing that hashtag and seeing all those women come together, she doesn't feel like she's on her own anymore. Mm. As daunting as the last few weeks have been for the complainant, no matter what, I believe that she believes what she's saying, and it's a perception issue. What has happened over the last few weeks, and character assessments, and horrific, traumatic moments in that trial for the complainant, would have very easily turned off any young girl from ever coming forward to report something that wasn't right. So if we do need to remedy that, and the hashtag is a remedy, hopefully will go some of the way towards making people feel more comfortable about coming forward if they feel that something is wrong.
Yeah. And I think the reason that that hashtag and the rallies yesterday were so powerful and so supported was because that realistically, the vast majority of women in Ireland have some sort of experience or something that resonated with them. This trial was triggering for a lot of people, and like it just brought out something. And the reason that so many people can stand by her and say that I believe her is because it is believable, is because rape is still a credible threat to women in this day and age, and it's happening to everyone. So it's not specifically about that one person or this one trial. It's about rape culture as a whole, and what are we going to do about it, and how do we fix it, and how do we change people, and how do we educate people on consent?
Mm-hmm. And it's about also the victim, that her story doesn't end with the verdict. The Emily Doe case in the States, was it maybe 2 years ago? Brock Turner was convicted of rape and got 6 months in prison, and it was a lot more cut and dry. She was unconscious behind a bin, and he had sex with her while she was unconscious, and he was chased down by two witnesses who were so disturbed by what they'd seen that they could hardly relay the story, and the judge didn't want to ruin Brock Turner's future. He was a champion swimmer, a great athlete, and all of these facts were brought up as part of his character assessment, which unfortunately in that case it was different because there was witnesses, but often in a rape case there's one person's word against another person's word, and all we have to go on is character assessments, and that's where the system is inherently flawed, because why would you ever report a rape knowing that your character is going to be broken down? And they will wonder, well, this type of behaviour is conducive to rape. And then you're blamed. But the Brock Turner case, what Emily Doe had said at the time, and she released an amazing statement after the trial, but she had said that one comment that particularly stuck with her was a guy had said, "This is so sad. I really hope my daughter never ends up like her." And for Emily Doe, it was the word "ends up" in that she felt that this story was the end of her story, that now going forward, she was the girl who got raped.
Yeah.
And he will move on and go back to being a swimmer after his 6 months, because the judge is protecting his future. And then here again, Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding will go forward, and they've signed with new clubs in England or whatever, and there is an impression that but this girl will always be the girl from that trial, whereas the guys won't be touched in that way.
And that's like it's really terrifying. Like, there's a couple of things that I want to someone asked me, do you think it's fair that they play rugby again, that they go on and they represent Ireland? And I don't think it is. I don't think they should be. I don't think they should, because I don't think they're a good representation of this country. And I think regardless of the verdict, the way they spoke about women in those WhatsApp messages and the way that they were so incredibly disrespectful to all women is just testament to the fact that I just think that that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be celebrated. They shouldn't be part of an institution that is supposed to represent the best of the best in this country, because they're not.
Well, when you're a rugby player of that stature, you are a role model.
Yeah.
And there are certain behavioural things that you sign on to. I know that there are actually contracts that dictate how you behave as a role model and as someone who's representing the IRFU. And certainly that's not it. And if anything, this has been, it really has blown open a dark side of rugby culture, a misogyny and a flippant attitude maybe towards women and sex, that no matter what way you look at it, is harmful.
Yeah.
Particularly in those texts, it's damaging and it's harmful, and there's no doubt that that needs to change, and hopefully it will. But consent is still very, very difficult.
Consent is very difficult. And I think this is at the heart of the, this is the reason why the conviction wasn't, there wasn't another conviction. We don't have a consistent understanding in this country of what consent is and what rape is, okay? There are a lot of very loaded comments coming out from this trial and a lot of loaded statements. Things like, oh, she fancied him and she looked like she was after him and it looked like she wanted to approach him, whatever. And the implication there is that if you fancy someone, the sheer act of having a crush on someone is consenting, which it isn't, of course. So let's break it down. Let's really talk about how we feel about consent and what I think would help people going forward. I think you can as a girl go out and wear whatever you want, drink as much as you want, and you can consent to kissing, whatever, and at any time, at any point in the night, you can withdraw your consent.
Absolutely, of course. But we do have to acknowledge that if we're all confused about what consent looks like, it's not easy to unpack. It's not always easy to see what consent is or if someone's consenting. So we do have to acknowledge that. And that's what I really, really struggle with. And yeah. I don't know, do you remember the Aziz Ansari story from a few months back?
Yeah.
And she had pursued him and admits that she had asked him on the date and then he had said no. And then she asked him again and he said yes. And they went on the date and he was rude at dinner. And she went home with him and he was trying to have sex with her. And she said, oh, I don't have sex on the first date. And he said, if I pour you a glass of wine, is that the second date? And she obviously felt that this was really inappropriate and kind of came out and really did damage his character. It was a character assassination. But here's what's tricky for me. We've grown up in Ireland being told girls can't have sex on the first date. Mm. And it's bad and it's wrong and our relationship with sex is massively flawed and we've chatted about that before. Yeah. We have a really weird relationship with sex in Ireland as women. So we're told, say no, say no, say no. You should never say yes straight away.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, sometimes people say no and they're going to have sex and they want to, but they're saying no.
Okay.
So no,
okay.
And they're saying no because they've been told you should say no. You should not be seen to be very readily available to have sex.
Yeah. Okay. I think this one is such a careful thing to talk about because, yes, people be like, oh no, and then there's other cues that are indicating that they're saying yes. So, you know, there is no behavior there that you can attribute to someone who's being raped. And this is something that came up a lot in the trial, was that, oh, she didn't scream. The girl who came into the room said she didn't look like she was being raped. She didn't cry out. There was middle class girls downstairs. Why didn't she cry out? Sure, they wouldn't stand for rape. All these horrendous comments. There is no behavior there there is no standardized rape victim. There is no tick box procedure where you can process, you can look at someone and be like, oh yes, you know, they're being raped or whatever. There are body language cues that indicate that you want to have sex with someone. Like if you can be having a conversation and be doing something else entirely, but as long as you're willingly and engaging with it and doing it and that you're pursuing some of the actions as well, you know, that it's mutual, you can tell that, and you know that yourself, and people know that in situations or whatever. I think the problem with this is that when we're talking about body language, there's such a large room for error. There's such a margin of error there that can occur. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what has happened, because, you know, those lads said, I assume she wanted it, or she didn't scream or whatever. Like, it's disgusting. You can't say because someone didn't scream doesn't mean that they wanted it, but they misread body language.
A few people misread her body language in the situation. So from my perspective, young boys are growing up with the idea that girls will always say no, or they're not easy. They shouldn't be easy. And a girl that you want to be with won't be easy. And she'll say no the first few times. She won't have sex on the first date. And there is that double standard. And like, I've spoken to lads themselves who will all have sex on the first date and still say, oh, if a girl had sex with me on the first date, I probably wouldn't get back in touch with her, which is a horrific double standard. But they grow up with this learned behavior that she'll say no. And there's phrases like, oh, I cracked her, or, you know, I finally got her into bed last night, or whatever. And that's sort of a culture that aspect needs to change. And that's education and making women feel empowered and making sure that this doesn't turn into, oh, sex is a really bad thing. And if you do want to have a threesome, it's really bad and you should be ashamed. We have such a weird relationship with sex that's where some of the cracks, I think, start to show. So if we can
have such an unhealthy attitude towards sex and sexual empowerment completely and utterly. Like, it's just kind of, you get your sex ed when you're 12 and that's it, boxed off. And that doesn't include any sort of real descriptions on, you know, intersex relationships, all different things or whatever. So it's just, you get your very, very quick talking to when you're young in primary school. Then we don't, so there because consent, the whole issue of consent has been on, it has been a conversation topic for a couple of years now, especially after the likes of Asking for It. People have debated this on and off again, and it's like, well, if she consented to this, doesn't mean she's consenting to that. If she's gone this far along, surely she's going to that. If her body language said this, maybe she meant that. If she didn't say no specifically, she was consenting. If she didn't scream, she was consenting. And then a lot of people now are like, oh, consent is this big, massive elephant in the room that, you know, you need to get. And people are making jokes like, oh, do you have to sign a waiver before you go into the room? No, you don't. Consent is as simple as saying, is this okay?
Mm-hmm.
Can I do this? Can I, you know, do you mind? Are you still okay with this? Small little sentences. It doesn't have to be, do you consent to me having sex with you? Do you consent to this act? But just checking in and saying, are you sure you want to do this? Is this all right? Is this fine? Can I do it this way? Can I try this? Whatever. These small little
just showing
questions.
That you're aware.
Yeah, showing that you're aware and checking in and
respect.
Not going on with the process and not going 100% through the process without asking any of those questions or without stopping to think and just assuming all the way through that everything you're doing is fine. I think just... There's this whole notion that getting consent would ruin the moment, that you're passionately making out with someone and you go into a room and you don't want to stop, you just want to keep going and it's passion or whatever. But I'd rather see someone fucking ruin the moment than ruin a life, like, you know.
Yeah, 100%. And like, it is that simple, and it's respect and awareness and feeling what the other person is feeling or trying to feel what they're feeling. But it ends up coming down to nitty gritty factors, such as in that Brock Turner case, there was a massive argument over whether she was behind the bin or adjacent to the bin. Because if she was behind the bin, then it definitely wasn't consensual. But if she was beside the bin, maybe that was more consensual. So as if location specifics could indicate whether a situation was consensual or not. And those are the things we are forced to resort to when we're trying to unpick whether someone gave consent or not.
Yeah, and this is the thing. Is it up to us? Can it be determined by a jury whether someone gave consent or not? I don't think it can. And there were so many assumptions. And this is the thing, really, when you think about this trial. It wasn't those lads on trial. What was on trial was the word rape. Nobody can deny that something happened. There was, you know, there was sexual activity in that room that had occurred between three people. What people are questioning is whether that, what happened there, is rape or not. And it's like how we're trying too hard and putting it to a jury and putting it to a court to determine whether the fact that she had lacerations and bruises and injuries, does that constitute as rape? And they decided at the end of the day, no, it doesn't. And they had, I'm going to get upset talking about it, because there was evidence there that suggested that something untoward happened. That's all I'll say about it. But not enough to prosecute without room for doubt.
I mean, we're never going to get to the bottom of this, but I do hope that somewhere in a room in the near future, a lad will think twice. And that's a positive.
Yeah, what I think is a really positive, I've got two younger brothers. One's 24 and one's 21. And I wrote a piece for them before about consent, about kind of saying, look, I've never actually spoken to you guys about this. I acknowledge the culture that you are growing up in. I acknowledge that 90% of music has violent sexual references to women. I acknowledge that people and that women are there's just this massive kind of culture of pornification where like everything is sexual. There's a story there this morning about a Nickelodeon producer has ceased working with Nickelodeon because he's been sexualizing too many of the programs. And then there was like screenshots and stuff. And you're like, yeah, this is a far cry from the Powerpuff Girls, you know. So you grow up in a world and look at the likes of Geordie Shore, where the whole premise of that is that lads go out, get drunk, pick up girls, bang them, bring them back to the shag pad. Like the whole goal of that entire series, which is now in its what, like 10th year or something, is to get women, bring them back, bang them, get them out. Like the shag pad, all that kind of language and that culture is what my brothers have grown up in. So,
and again, they reinforce the idea on that show that some girls have sex easily and some don't, and that is directly equatable to their moral values, and you're a top tier girl if you don't have sex straight away.
Yeah, but I think the underlining premise and the underlining thing was that ultimately all girls do want to have sex and they will eventually have sex with you. And even
you
the
have
ones,
to crack them.
And even the ones who said at this, like the cast members who were like, I don't want to have sex, inevitably did. And it was seen as somewhat like, oh, it was romantic, I waited, or what he did this or whatever, and blah, 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 blah. And like, we also grew up with films where in the majority, vast majority of romantic comedies, you might have a guy who is, you know, you have that kind of chauvinistic guy, like the what's that film, The Hitch,
these
kind of characters, right, where they're really popular with women, they go out, they've no problem pulling, and then all of a sudden, or like in Crazy Stupid Love, Ryan Gosling's character, right, that these men can go out, they can pull women all the time, and then they one day find a woman who's not impressed with their charm and sophistication, and she's a little bit left of center, and she's just not bought into this whole idea of a chauvinistic guy. But with enough persistence, he eventually breaks her down and they live happily ever after. Or he constantly follows her. He meets her outside her office. He's got a coffee waiting out there. Like, we've grown up in a culture that has told lads, you're top lad if you can shag as many women as possible. Persistence is key, really, because if you just don't leave her alone and buy her a coffee or do whatever, she will crack down eventually. And then all of our music is just so, there's this massive kind of trend of pornification in music. So it's no real surprise to me that young boys are struggling with the idea of consent or genuinely don't think about it.
No.
You have to have active conversations with them. And I did talk to my brothers about it. And I said, look, if you're ever, I don't know what it's like when you go out for you. I don't know how many women approach you. But if you're ever in a situation where you feel like she could be more sober, or, you know, this, it's just, you're
just
kind
don't,
of
going,
just
yeah.
don't do it, like, yeah. and just don't do it. Take her phone number, take her home, you know, take her home back to her house, have a cup of tea. Just, if I just think that it's not killing the moment, it's not prudish to say, if you're out and you're drunk and you're whatever, and for your own selves as well, to just take a step back sometimes and consider it.
Yeah, I think that's so true about how immersed that message is in pop culture around the girl who's the one is the one who doesn't give it up easily. And I always remember when I was young, the story of when Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt first got together and she made him wait 3 months to have sex. And it was this massive story and it was headlines everywhere. And it really hit home with me as I was probably 12. And it was a really strong message to me that you have to make a man wait and that's when you're really, really valuable. And that is a damaging message, because then we feel conflicted and we give mixed messages because we don't want to be seen as someone who'd have sex easily. And that we really need to work on that and make sure that we're all very clear about the fact that there's nothing wrong with flirting with someone in a bar, wanting to have sex, and then deciding not to.
Yeah.
It's just about being more transparent with ourselves as well about how we feel. And
I mean, yeah, how often do we see it portrayed in film or media or whatever that there's the girl and the guy and she's making him wait and they're in bed and they're getting a bit, you know, it's getting a bit heated and she pulls away and she says no and he's left with blue balls and he's like, oh, head in the pillow kind of thing. But
or else,
oh my
she
God,
finally
you're so
gives
endearing.
In.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so endearing because you're wonderful. Mm-hmm.
That confuses people.
So if a guy is going to be in a similar situation and there is, or if a girl is in a similar situation where it's getting heated, you can still withdraw consent. But I think the culture we live in tells guys to push through and you can get her.
You'll get her. Like, just keep chipping away.
But that's fucking rape. Like, yeah, well, that's it though.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's just a little spark in my head just went off. I was like, that is rape culture. That is why we are where we are. And I think that the reason that a lot of men are struggling with the idea of I believe her and rape culture and saying that rape culture doesn't exist is because I think they genuinely don't realize that it exists.
It's education and it's just making people aware, because they have been oblivious to this. A lot of men have, and not all men, but some of the comments yesterday on Facebook and on Twitter were completely disgusting and a big insight into where we're at, and we have such a long way to go. But this conversation has helped me a little bit. I'm still completely confused. Like, we'll never get to the bottom of consent. We'll never find the answer.
I think people will have their own definitions of consent and they will live their lives by that, and that is fine. And what I want is for any guys out there who are reading this, or men, to go out and develop their own sense of consent. But what the problem is that we will never have a legal definition and a proof.
And everyone's sense of consent has to be the same in order for this to work. Because if we've differing perceptions of what consent means, then that is inherently the problem.
Yeah, but that's the thing. We can't. Because there won't be something that everyone agrees on. And then if we try and legislate it, or we try and have like this, this conceived notion of consent, then anything outside the parameter of that will be even harder to prosecute or whatever.
Yeah, like, we definitely just have to accept it'll never be black and white. And there's such a spectrum of variables in a case like this, in cases like this, where, you know, what's rough sex for one woman might be normal for another, or, you know, vanilla for another. There's a spectrum of behaviours, and what's okay for one person isn't okay for another, and we just have to be cognizant of that.
Yeah.
But conversations are important, and discussions, and I'm glad that, like, lads like your brother it's in their consciousness.
Yeah.
Whereas 10 years ago it wouldn't have been. No.
So there you have it. There are some of our favourite stories to have covered throughout the year. As always, we love hearing from you. So if you have any ideas about what you want us to talk about next, please do reach out and get in touch. Bye.
I'd like to propose a toast.
The Diet Coke Because I Can campaign is about carefree fun with friends and celebrating the things in life that make you feel good. Take part in the Diet Coke Because I Can series by following hashtag Because I Can.